All right, I'd like to call the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting to order. It's Thursday, February 26th at 3:31 p.m. We're in the Belts Committee Room in Juneau, Alaska, the state capital. I'd like to welcome Vice Chair Senator Bjorkman, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Wilikowski, and Senator Tilton will be joining us shortly. Myself, Chair Kawasaki, we do have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to thank Carrie Tupo with Senate Records and Chloe Miller with the Legislative Information Office today. We have three items on today's agenda. The first is a Senate Bill 236, Veterans Sentencing Program Criminal Procedures. It's sponsored by Senator Tobin. We have a first hearing on Senate Bill 162, Specie as Legal Tender by Senator Mike Kronk. And then we have a presentation on the domestic violence sexual assault and the systems that address them by Brenda Stanfill, Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. So, first, we're going to go ahead and hear Senate Bill 236, and I'd like to invite Lukey Gail Tobin and staff Louis Flora to present the legislation.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Lukey Gail Tobin, Senator for District I.
My name is Louis Flora, and I'm staff to Senator Lukey Tobin.
Thank you, and thank you, members of the committee. I want to start by saying that here in Alaska, thank you for your service should be more than just words. The purpose of Senate Bill 236, the Veteran Justice Act, is to help us recognize the sacrifice of veterans who have served this nation, sometimes the most dangerous of circumstances. The bill before you provides an alternative to incarceration through judicial interventions, such as probation or therapeutic courts, for eligible veterans who become involved in our criminal legal system. Now, every year, around 200,000 active duty service members separate from U.S. Armed Services. Too many of these veterans struggle with mental health challenges and substance abuse. And the factors that lead, such as these, contribute to their high rates of homelessness and criminal behavior. Right now, we know that 41% of veterans nationwide have reported challenges with alcohol and substance and drug misuse. About one-third of all veterans across the nation have reported at least one significant interaction with the criminal legal system. And it's estimated that over 181,000 veterans are currently incarcerated here in the United States today. In Alaska, we know that approximately 10% of our inmates are veterans. The proposed legislation before you would authorize judges in Alaska to take veterans' national service history and military experiences into account at sentencing. The act would create a veteran sentencing option that uses probation and treatment instead of incarceration, and it would create a presumption in favor of this veteran sentencing option, which we call a VSO, for any eligible offense for probation up to a Class C felony. This would include misdemeanors. Veterans who complete their case plan could avoid incarceration, and this presumption in favor would either have their case dismissed or their conviction not recorded, or have their felony converted to a misdemeanor. The Veterans Justice Act would specifically authorize the use of veteran treatment courts in Alaska. We do have two of these courts today. The bill before you would hopefully increase that number. Now, one key advantage of the statutory framework that is before you is, opposed to a traditional therapeutic court model, this would provide another pathway for veterans to access therapeutic courts, especially when those courts are inaccessible. The two courts we have today are in Anchorage and Fairbanks, and there's so much more of our state that could be served. SB 236 is one way we can honor our veterans for their sacrifice and ensure their accountability for their criminal behavior, but provide a pathway for successful reentry into our community. Now, this is the first introduction of this legislation, and we have heard concerns and feedback from many of our stakeholders. That includes the Department of Law and the Alaska court systems. And we believe that we have a good piece of legislation before us, but we know there is work to be done, and we are committed to that work. However, we recognize that you have to start somewhere, and that is why we introduced this legislation, to begin that conversation. At the core of this bill, I believe, is good public policy. It's public policy that recognizes the unique lived experiences of our service members and sometimes the very unfortunate consequences and realities of the impact of nationwide service of national service on our military members. Now, we do have a sexual analysis that we can walk you through to understand the components of the bill, and we do have several invited testifiers as well. With your prerogative, Mr. Chairman, we can go through a sexual analysis or hear from our invited testifiers.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. Let's go ahead and hear the sectional.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Louis Flora. I'm staff to Senator Lukey Tobin. Here's the sectional analysis for Senate Bill 236. We call it the Veterans Justice Act. Section 1 establishes that an arresting officer shall ask a detained person about their veteran status. Section 2 adds a subsection to the bail and release procedure statute requiring the court to inform a person of the veteran sentencing program option. Section 3 authorizes the court to set aside a conviction or reduce a felony to a misdemeanor under the veteran sentencing program. Section 4 is the heart of the bill. Section 4 establishes the veteran sentencing program and the sentencing and probation chapter of the Code of Criminal Procedure. Subchapter A authorizes the court to proceed with sentencing a qualified offender under the veteran sentencing program. B establishes that a veteran is eligible for the veteran sentencing program if one or more mental or physical symptoms derived from military service have contributed to the offense. C allows the court to determine an offender ineligible for the veteran sentencing program if they present a threat to public safety. D establishes options for sentencing under the veteran sentencing program. E requires the court to establish the conditions for a veteran's participation in the program and conduct a final hearing to determine successful completion. F authorizes the court, upon successful completion of the program, to set aside, reduce, or expunge the conviction. G establishes that trauma unrelated to military service cannot be used to deny the existence of a condition resulting from military service. And H defines terms utilized in the veteran sentencing program. Section 5 of the bill establishes a veteran's overseas deployment exposure to danger, a service-related disability, or a service-related merit as a mitigating factor in sentencing. Section 6 requires the Alaska Criminal Justice Data Analyst Commission to track outcome data for those veterans who have participated in the veteran sentencing program and to conduct evaluations of the program. Section 7 establishes that if enacted, the veteran sentencing program constitutes a court rule change at Rule 35, that's reduction, correction, or a suspension of sentence, and at Rule 43, dismissal and deferred prosecution. And Section 8 is the conditional effect, stating that a two-third vote of the legislature is required to enact the court rule changes contained in the legislation. And finally, Section 9 is the effective date.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Flora, for the sectional analysis. I'd like to note for the record, Senator Wilikowski has been here for some time. Are there any initial questions for the sponsor of the legislation? I guess I will ask a question, and then whoever wants to answer can answer. I will note that there are several folks on Teams and also online to either answer questions or to testify on behalf of the bill, and so there might be somebody better to answer the question. But just a really quick question on Section 1 of the bill. It asks immediately after arrest to ask a that the officer shall question the prisoner in custody. And I guess I just have a question about immediately after arrest, normally they're being Mirandized, and I don't know if that is contrary to that request.
Chair Kawasaki, this is Louis Flora, staff to Senator Lukey Tobin. And we derived this language from a nationwide model act that has been put in place in other jurisdictions. And so I believe we have Brock Hunter on the line, who is integral in passing this act in Minnesota, who could speak to that, the issues with the Miranda and the questioning overall. I did learn in this morning's hearing in the other body that there is this legislature passed a law authorizing a star to be put on your ID or your driver's license that indicates your former military service. So there are indicators and ways that they could obtain that information. But I did read in some of the comments from Department of Law and others that there is that concern out there, and we're more than happy to address it as we progress with the bill.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Flora. I appreciate that. Are there any other questions for the sponsor, Senator Wilikowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, that was one question I had, is if an officer doesn't ask the question, or maybe the person who's arrested just doesn't want to speak, is there, and then they don't get put into, they don't get offered this program, have their rights been violated somehow? That's question number one. Question number two is, did you get anything back from legal? Because you're creating a separate class, and whether or not this is, any legal issues arise from doing this constitutionally, treating this class differently?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, we've had numerous iterations of the bill with legal, and to my recollection, this has not come up as creating a separate class has not been worked upon by legal, but we could go back and obtain that.
Thank you. Any Senator Wilikowski follow up?
Yeah, and then on the other issue of the failure to, if there is a failure to ask them, for example, does that create a legal challenge down the road, maybe for the person who's arrested?
For the record, Lukey Tobin, Senator for District I. We do think Brock Hunter would be able to answer this more thoroughly about how this has been enacted in other states and other situations, examples they've gone through. We have gone back and forth around whether we would require the officer to determine whether it was a veteran or if there should be an attestation by the actual person who's being arrested. That is definitely something we can continue to explore as we work through this legislation.
Great. Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. Are there further questions for the sponsor? We do have some testimony of folks who may be able to clarify the legislation. Okay. Hearing and seeing none, we're going to go ahead and open up invited and public testimony. The first person we have on our list to testify on behalf of the sponsor of the bill is Brock Hunter. Brock Hunter is the co-founder of the Veterans Defense Project. He's a former Army Scout who now works as an attorney focused on defending fellow veterans in the criminal justice system. He's also the co-founder of the Veterans Defense Project, which is a nonpartisan policy and education organization dedicated to restoring veterans in the criminal justice system to the communities they served. Brock has served on the board of directors of All Rise and its subsidiary, Justice for Vets, the nation's leading training and advocacy organization for problem-solving courts and Veterans Treatment Court, respectively. More recently, Brock served as an advisor to the National Veterans Justice Commission, a project chaired by former Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel. There, he helped develop the model legislation embodied in Senate Bill 236. Based on legislation, he and the Veterans Defense Project helped pass into law in Minnesota in 2021. Brock, welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee. If you could state your name, welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki, and members of the committee. Thank you for the invitation to speak today. Also, thank you to Senator Tobin for introducing Senate Bill 236 and its companion bill in the House introduced by Representative Stapp. As indicated, this bill builds upon Alaska's existing Veterans Treatment Court to efficiently expand access to therapeutic interventions for veterans who face criminal charges across the state of Alaska, simultaneously recognizing their service and sacrifice, reducing recidivism, protecting public safety, and creating cost savings for the state in the long term. Today, in my testimony, I'd like to cover three topics. First, unique factors in this modern generation of veterans and the resulting challenges that we face in reintegrating them back into our communities. Second, how this legislation builds upon Alaska's current system of veterans treatment courts. And finally, our experiences in Minnesota, where, as noted, we have enacted a law very similar to this in 2021 and are already seeing some very positive results. With respect to our modern generation of veterans, I would note that as long as veterans have returned from war, most have come back stronger and wiser from their service, immediate assets to their communities. But we now recognize that some have always brought their war home with them, buried invisible wounds that today we call post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, and other related conditions. And we also now recognize that untreated, these echoes of war have often manifested in self-destructive, reckless, and violent behavior that have reverberated through our society, destroying not only the lives of our veterans, but also victimizing their families and the communities that our veterans serve to protect. In this way, large numbers of veterans in past generations have fallen into the justice system, and far too many have been left behind there. Over the past 20 years, our military has fought the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, our nation's longest wars, simultaneously, making this generation the most heavily deployed in our country's history. Without a draft that we've relied upon in past conflicts, this generation has been relatively small, and the burden of fighting has fallen on fewer shoulders. We've only been able to maintain these long wars without a draft by redeploying troops over and over and over again in ways we've never done before. And today, 2 and 3 combat tours among this modern generation are commonplace. Some of our veterans have served many more. In our legal practice, our current record is a veteran who served 13 combat deployments with Army Special Operations, and he is quick to point out that he is nothing special, and he has friends still serving that are now up over 20 deployments post-9/11. These multiple deployments have translated into higher rates of post-traumatic stress than previous generations and resultantly higher rates of criminal justice contact. It's also important to note that this generation of veterans is also the most lethal in our country's history, having received the most sophisticated combat training that our country has ever come by, and then deploying these veterans to serve often multiple deployments where they've honed those skills. What these dynamics have combined to create public health and public safety crisis. And one of the best and most direct ways to respond to this crisis is in our criminal justice system, where we have the opportunity to leverage and ensure our troubled veterans receive the intervention they need to address the underlying issues and join the rest of our veterans as assets to their communities. Turning now to the Veterans Treatment Courts in Alaska and how this legislation would add to the work, great work that's already been done in Alaska. I would note that VTCs, Veterans Treatment Courts, are an amazing welcome response to this crisis that we find ourselves in. The biggest issue with them, though, is that we don't have enough of them. They're far too few in number, intervening with only a small fraction of the veterans coming through our justice system. While Alaska leads our nation with the highest population of veterans per capita, it has only 2 veterans courts in Fairbanks and Anchorage. And while they're doing great work, the majority of the jurisdictions in Alaska have no intervention tool with veterans, many of whom live outside these larger urban areas. Establishing VTCs in every jurisdiction would be great, but it's not realistic and it's not financially feasible. What this bill does is provides an efficient alternative to jurisdictions that don't have and may never have a Veterans Treatment Court, giving judges tools to essentially create a one Veterans Treatment Court on a case-by-case basis as they find it appropriate. You've already heard the main workings of this bill. I don't want to duplicate that, but I would just note that this is not meant to replace existing veterans courts. And in jurisdictions that have a Veterans Treatment Court, what this tool would do is allow the VTCs to focus on high risk, high need veteran offenders and give an alternative option of a therapeutic intervention for those who don't need the intensive supervision and resources that a VTC involves. And finally, in Minnesota, where we passed this law in 2021, we've had a great experience. I think it's notable that our legislature, one of the only divided legislatures in our country right now, passed this bill unanimously in 2021, full bipartisan support. And we also have the support of the Prosecutors Association and domestic violence and other victims groups as well. As we have implemented this bill and we've started to see numbers coming back from our Sentencing Guidelines Commission, we're seeing that it is working. This last year, we...
Uh-oh.
one of them successfully completed their program. I would also note that we've seen an increase in the number of veterans in our veterans treatment courts, ironically, though the law does not specifically address that. And finally, I would note that this law is actually saving Minnesota money. The fiscal note from the Minnesota legislature identified cost savings in the form of saved prison beds and reduced litigation costs, with an estimated savings of around $1 million per year to the state. We also have seen an increased efficiency in tapping the federally funded resources of the Veterans Administration and bringing those resources more readily available into our courts. I want to thank the committee for this opportunity to testify today, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hunter. There was a question earlier. I don't know if Senator Wilkowski wants to, regarding Equal Protection Clause. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. I was just curious if there were any constitutional issues that arose creating a different class in sentencing and treatment of prisoners or treatment of people who are arrested, convicted of crimes.
Chair Kawasaki and Senator, it's a great question, and it's one that was raised very early on in the Veterans Treatment Court movement as to whether or not we are creating a separate class of offenders. Over the years, that concern, I think, has been allayed, recognizing that this is a category of offenders that are unique in some aspects, in that their issues that are bringing them into the courts relate directly to their military service on behalf of their country, and that they have underlying mental health and substance abuse issues that are most readily addressed through a therapeutic intervention. So while there were concerns early on around VTCs and veteran sentencing legislation, it's been many years since any of those issues have really been at the fore.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hunter. Are there any questions for the speaker? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we're going to go move on to the next person in line that we have. We have Phil Hokanson from Fairbanks, a U.S. Army veteran. He serves as the chair of the Alaska Veterans Advisory Council and is a member of the Alaska Pioneer Home Advisory Board. Phil's an instructor of business administration and applied management at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and lives just down the street from me. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Kawasaki. Thank you, committee. Appreciate the opportunity today to testify in support of SB 236, which I really do believe will improve processes with regard to justice-involved veterans to ensure that more of them have access to the incredible resource that is the Veterans Court. So not every veteran who accesses vet court is facing incarceration necessarily, but for those who are, it's worth noting that when a veteran is incarcerated, that loss is societal. A family might lose income and stability. The VA shuts off disability payments, and the state incurs costs of incarceration. And also sidelines individuals who've already proven their commitment to this nation by volunteering to defend our country and successfully completing rigorous military training and terms of honorable service. Veterans have demonstrated that their discipline and resilience. So those same qualities can be redirected in the vet court model towards rehabilitation and recovery. So rather than allowing incarceration or even just merely criminal justice system involvement to compound loss, the Veterans Court model leverages their proven capacity for structure and commitment to help restore veterans. SB 236 strengthens the intake of veterans into the Veterans Court program by identifying them and informing them of their eligibility much earlier in the processing. It emphasizes individualized treatment plans that are tailored to a veteran's specific needs to address things like mental health, substance use, other potential barriers to success. And importantly, since not all crimes are equal, it commits to a strong public safety standard, making participation contingent on the court's determination that it's appropriate and safe. One advantage that veterans have, particularly in a state like ours, with the highest concentration of veterans in the country, is that there's dedicated resources to support their behavioral health care needs through the Alaska VA healthcare system and its Veterans Justice Outreach Coordinators, the vet centers that are in several of our communities, and countless community care resources like the Cohen Behavioral Health Clinics that also focus heavily on veterans. There are willing veteran mentors as well, who are often distinguished community members dedicated to walking with them on their path to rehabilitation. One that I'd like to recognize, Paul Peralt, is a retired professional engineer and a deacon in the Catholic Diocese of Fairbanks. And he actually snowbirds down in New Mexico now, but still makes time to speak regularly, not only to those who's currently mentoring in the Veterans Court, but also graduates of the program. So, you know, there's recognition that the bonds that are forged through the program are particularly strong. And the reality is that it isn't an easy program to get through. There's regular check-ins with the court, the probation officer, the veteran mentor. There's potentially drug testing. There's a required behavioral health course of care. Plenty of veterans have been informed of the option and declined because it requires a guilty plea, and they also recognize how challenging the program can be. SB 236, I think, provides further incentive for veterans to choose this road less traveled by providing for the possibility of having their conviction downgraded, potentially expunged upon completion of the program. Criminal convictions have lifelong employment consequences, and this really does provide a brighter light at the end of the tunnel for veterans as well as their families. I think Veterans Court are the gold standard for reducing recidivism among justice-involved veterans and facilitating their successful reintegration into their communities. The current programs in Anchorage and Fairbanks have demonstrated not only improved outcomes for participating veterans, but I think also more efficient use of limited criminal justice and treatment resources. Passing SB 236 would honor the service of veterans, potentially reduce future crime, and save state dollars by diverting eligible individuals into a program with proven better long-term outcomes. So for these reasons, I urge support of SB 236. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee, for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hokanson. Are there any questions? I just wanted to thank you for being online today, and also thank you for your service. And I forgot to mention that to Brock Hunter as well. All the four who are testifying today on behalf of this bill were service members. Okay, we have next in line, we have Tammy Perot. Tammy serves as the Northwest Regional Liaison for the Department of War, supporting military family quality of life policy across six states. She provides key insight and advice specific to Alaska and coordinates Alaska with all the services, Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, Space Force, and the Coast Guard. Ms. Perot is a U.S. Army combat veteran. Want to welcome you in very familiar committee here, Ms. Perot.
Senator Kawasaki and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tammy Perot, and I serve as the Northwest Regional Liaison with the Defense State Liaison Office, a part of the Department of War. First off, I'd like to thank Senator Tobin, with the support of her staff, for bringing this important bill forward. The policies within Senate Bill 236 fall under a state policy priority that the Defense State Liaison Office has supported for over a decade. And that was establishing veteran treatment courts and expanding sentencing options for service members and veterans. So I had to dig through some historic files to go back to the work we did in 2015 and look at those policies that we supported. And we support those policies and the policies within this bill, not only for what they do for the court system and what they do for veterans, but for an underlying factor that has not yet been mentioned, and that is to prevent veteran suicide. When we discussed the establishment of veterans treatment courts, we sought to expand access to those courts and these policies to the largest population possible. And we couldn't foresee the work that those that have gone before me in testimony coming to fruition. For the state of Alaska, it seems obvious that geography would create significant limitations for access to VTCs. And the policy before you today is a clear step to ensure access to alternative sentencings and ensure that it is not restricted to just those who can reach VTCs in Fairbanks and Anchorage. This is an innovative and effective means to support those who serve our nation. By enacting cohesive alternative sentencing programs, veterans can obtain specialized treatment and services they need to resolve outstanding criminal offenses, and most importantly, are given the opportunity to stabilize their lives. We support this because it makes these programs accessible to the largest extent possible. And SB 236 clarifies and expands those who are eligible. By requiring the courts to inform everyone of the veteran sentencing option, this bill seeks to maximize access to these programs. The clear guidance in Section 4 ensures consistency across jurisdictions and avoids a patchwork of programs available across and makes this available across the state. We support the intent of this legislation to incentivize treatment by ensuring veterans have the potential of having all qualifying charges reduced or dismissed. This Senate bill is a promise to help service members transition back to their communities and families in a healthful and productive manner. This is a promise that helps not only our veterans, but their families. I stand for your questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Perot. Just because you have the experience of having served six other states, we heard a little bit from Mr. Hunter about the Minnesota law. Do you know, are other states pursuing this in the six areas that you have been in, and have they been met with the same questions?
Senator Kawasaki, thank you very much for the question. We have not worked on this specific legislation in other states in my region. However, my colleague in Minnesota had provided me an update on the success of this legislation in Minnesota and how it has been life-changing for so many veterans that he has heard from. So I, again, defer to Mr. Hunter on that question about other states who may be working on this. We see a lot of expansion and continued interest in improving veterans treatment courts and sentencing options for our service members and veterans. And we appreciate that continued work of states to recognize this unique population and the unique challenges they face when they return from combat or other operations.
Super. Thank you very much, Ms. Perot. Are there further questions? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we will next move along to Mr. Zach Federico. He is the Director of Veterans and Military Affairs Task Force at the American Legislative Exchange Council, where he collaborates with state legislators, veterans organizations, and private sector leaders to develop policies to support the military community. In addition to his role at ALEC, Zach is a musician with the 29th Infantry Division Band in the Virginia Army National Guard. Zach is a euphonium and trombone player and has supported numerous ceremonies and has played for dignitaries such as President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, and Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin. Welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee.
Thank you. Chairman Kawasaki, Vice Chairman Bjorkman, and members of the committee, My name is Zach Federico, and I serve as the Director of the Veterans and Military Affairs Task Force at the American Legislative Exchange Council. Thank you for the opportunity to share ALEC's nonpartisan research and analysis as you consider this legislation. ALEC is the nation's largest nonpartisan voluntary membership organization of state legislators, dedicated to the principles of limited government, free markets, and federalism. The ALEC Veterans and Military Affairs Task Force includes more than 100 state legislators and private sector leaders who collaborate to develop model policies that support our nation's veterans, service members, and military families. One of these models is the Veterans Justice Act, which, like SB 236, creates alternative sentencing options for certain veterans whose offenses may be linked to service-related conditions. This policy has been implemented in Minnesota, signed into law in Nebraska, and introduced this year in West Virginia, Kansas, Colorado, and Alaska. This approach upholds justice while recognizing the unique challenges that many veterans face. Research demonstrates a strong connection between combat deployments and adverse mental health outcomes, including post-traumatic stress disorder, substance use disorder, and traumatic brain injury. Today, service members are deploying at higher rates than previous generations, with 77% of post-9/11 veterans having deployed, compared to 58% of pre-9/11 veterans. After military service, most service members transition successfully to civilian life. However, some still struggle with the invisible wounds of service and become involved in the criminal justice system. While veteran treatment courts have shown positive results, publicly available data from 2024 shows that they are only available in about 17% of counties. This leaves many veterans without access based solely on where they live. By establishing alternative sentencing options, Alaska can provide judges with the discretion to place eligible veterans in treatment and probation when appropriate, rather than relying solely on traditional sentencing. This approach supports accountability, recognizes service, and strengthens public safety. Thank you for your time and attention. I'm happy to answer any questions from members of the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Federico. You mentioned that Nebraska had just signed it into law. Do you know roughly out of the 50 states how many states are pursuing legislation like this or have already passed it?
The ones that I've seen so far, Mr. Chairman. The ones I've seen so far are Minnesota is the only one that's implemented it. Nebraska has passed it into law, but it hasn't been implemented quite yet. Got passed pretty much, I think it passed unanimously through Nebraska. And then West Virginia, Kansas, and Colorado are the three other states that are considering it this session.
Great. Thank you very much for the clarification. Are there any questions for Mr. Federico? Okay, hearing and seeing none again, thanks for being online. We appreciate that you're joining us from the East Coast. Let's see, do we have anybody else? I have nobody else online for testimony at this time. Do we have any questions? We do have also in the room, we do have Nancy Mead, who's just hanging out there in the back or in front now, for any questions you might have about the court system. We also have Lisa Purinton. She's the director of the Division of Statewide Services at the Department of Public Safety online out of Anchorage. Are there any questions for those two? No questions. Okay. Getting off pretty easy today. I would like to invite the sponsor of the bill back before the committee to see if she has any last comments for the committee today, and then see if the committee has any questions of you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Lukey Tobin, Senate District I. I want to thank the committee for allowing us to introduce this bill and also for listening to our invited testifiers. I think the very moving testimony today really speaks toward the truth that this is good public policy and that it will help Alaskans, not just Alaskans who are service members, but their families and our communities. I do want to recognize once again that there are concerns we have heard from stakeholders about the legislation before you, and it is our intent and commitment to continue working with all stakeholders to ensure that the policies and the approach meet and address all concerns and needs. So we're looking forward to continuing the collaboration and discussions and to hopefully having this bill become law in the near future.
Any other questions of the sponsor of the bill? Okay. Thank you very much. We will go ahead and set Senate Bill 236 aside for a future hearing. Thank you, Senator Tobin. We're going to take a brief at ease and then bring up the next bill. I'd like to call the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting back to order. We're now on our second item, and that is Senate Bill 162, sponsored by Senator Mike Kronk. It is species legal tenor. It is right before us. We've seen a bill like this in a prior year. I don't think we've seen it yet this year. So welcome to the committee, Senator Kronk.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki, and members of the State Affairs.
For the record, Paul Menke, staff to Senator Mike Kronk.
Senator Mike Kronk, I represent District R, which is Copper River Valley, all the interior, Yukon River, and West Fairbanks. Thank you for hearing this bill today. Senate Bill 162 is the companion bill to House Bill 1, which was the reintroduction of House Bill 3 from the 33rd Alaska Legislature. That bill passed out of the other body to the Senate, made it to Senate State Affairs, and then Finance, where it stalled there due to budget priorities that year. Senate Bill 162 is about constitutional fidelity and financial freedom. Article 1, Section 10 of the United States Constitution explicitly recognizes gold and silver as legal tender. In fact, gold and silver are the only forms of currency explicitly mentioned in the Constitution. This bill aligns Alaska statute with that constitutional authority. Specifically, it recognizes gold and silver as legal tender in Alaska to the fullest extent allowed under federal law. It ensures that money itself is not taxed as a commodity, and it protects individual choice. Across the country, states are revisiting sound money policy, and Alaska should not fall behind. 45 states have already eliminated state-level sales tax and use taxes on precious metals. Version N of House Bill 1 reflects collaboration and refinement. It incorporates amendments offered by members of the other body, adopted in House State Affairs, to clarify original intent and address operational concerns. Senate Bill 162 in front of you reflects Version A of House Bill 1, and I would love to work with this committee on getting those bipartisan changes incorporated into this bill in a committee substitute. That process helped clarify the scope of this legislation, both in what it does and what it does not do. So let's be clear about what SB 162 does not do. SB 162 does not create a state currency. It does not mandate acceptance of specie by private entities. It does not eliminate municipal authority. For fiscal context, Alaska does not have a sales tax, and local municipalities do not track precious metals sales separately. So the precise fiscal impact is indeterminate. Given the limited volume of these transactions in Alaska, any potential local revenue impact is expected to be minimal. You can see that noted in the fiscal note. This bill ensures that gold and silver specie are not treated as taxable commodities, but instead are treated consistently with other lawful forms of money. SB 162 does not attempt to reform federal monetary policy. It simply provides Alaskans with an additional lawful option to exchange currency. It restores constitutional clarity, protects individual choice, it treats money as money. In closing, this legislation provides parity for Alaskans to align with a growing national trend of sound money policy. Alaska would become the 12th state to reaffirm gold and silver as legal tender. So let's move Alaska forward. With that, Mr. Chair, I thank you, and I'd like to turn it over to my staff, who will go through a sectional analysis and describe the clarifying changes made to HB 1 in the other body that we would like incorporated into the bill.
Great. Thank you, Senator Kronk. Mr. Menke.
For the record, Paul Menke, staff to Senator Mike Kronk. Sections 1 and 2 of SB 162 amend AS 29.10.200 to prohibit boroughs and cities from imposing sales and use taxes on specie. Through the additions of new subsections N and I, this prevents local governments from taxing gold and silver purchases or exchanges. Section 3 updates AS 29.45.650A to include a prohibition on taxing specie for boroughs. This reinforces the intent that specie as legal tender should not be subject to taxation at the borough level. Section 4 adds AS 29.45.650M, specifically banning boroughs from taxing specie transactions. This extends the prohibition to all municipalities, ensuring uniformity across the state. Section 5 amends AS 29.45.700A to align city taxation with the borough restrictions in Section 4. And Section 6 adds AS 29.45.700A explicitly prohibiting cities from taxing specie. Section 7 creates AS 44.12.400 designating specie, gold and silver coins or bullion, as valid currency. This includes coins issued by the U.S. or recognized foreign governments and any state-approved specie if authorized. This section does not mandate the acceptance of specie by any private entity, but gives the authority to recognize specie as valid currency. Additionally, Section 7 directs the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to study the potential of adding additional legal tender options. And if I may briefly go over the changes made in the other body for the clarifying amendments, the changes made in version N of HB 1 makes three substantive clarifications within the bill. So first, relating to municipal tax clarifications for boroughs and cities, there was an amendment that narrows the exception so that boroughs and cities may not tax the intrinsic gold or silver value contained within the specie while preserving municipal authority to tax dealer premiums, services, or collectible value. There is also an amendment to add no mandate for government entities to accept specie as for payments for debts or taxes. And the third amendment directed the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to for the study to now include consumer protections and consumer behavior related to the sale and use of specie. And that concludes the changes made in version N of HB 1.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Menke and Senator Kronk. Are there any questions for the sponsor of the bill? I guess I just had one question, because right now, I guess you addressed it in the House version of this bill about government entities being required to accept it. So I'm guessing that change that is in the current House bill would apply, so that if state government says you owe this much, this is the lien on your property, whatever, you can pay it, they would be able to pay it in gold, and that would correct it, the amendment in House Bill 1.
That's correct. For the record, Paul Menke, to Chair Kawasaki, that amendment did clarify that. No governmental entity would be required to accept gold for payment. They theoretically could, but they are not be required to.
Cool. Thank you very much. Any further questions? Okay, thank you. Hearing and seeing none, we're going to go ahead and open up invited and public testimony, where we do have one person under invited testimony to speak, and that is J.P. Cortez. J.P. is the executive director of the Sound Money Defense League, an organization working to remonetize gold and silver through nationwide legislative efforts. He's a graduate of Auburn University and a resident of Charlotte, North Carolina. J.P. is the lead author of the Sound Money Index. J.P., if you'd state your name and your affiliation, welcome to the Senate State Affairs Committee.
Hi there. My name is J.P. Cortez. I'm the executive director of the Sound Money Defense League. Senator Kawasaki and members of the Senate State Affairs Committee, I thank you very much for the opportunity to testify before you today in support of Senate Bill 162. I'd like to thank Senator Kronk and Representative McCabe on the House side for their work on this important yet very simple measure. On behalf of the Sound Money Defense League, we stand in strong support of the current version of Senate Bill 162, and this ensures that gold and silver coins and bullion are tax-free across the state and reaffirms these assets as legal tender in the state of Alaska under the auspices of the U.S. Constitution. I would start by saying purchasers of bullion are uniquely mobile. In this case, an Alaskan citizen who wanted to avoid this tax could simply travel to a nearby locality. Additionally, there are plenty of online and out-of-state precious metal dealers that offer ways for people to acquire or buy or invest in gold and silver without having to collect taxes, for example, by storing it in the depository in a state without a tax. Plenty of people take advantage of that as a way to avoid having to pay their own state or local sales tax. I also want to bring up that the Alaska Municipal League had issues with prior versions of the bill, but as was discussed earlier with the amendments and the great work from the two sponsors on the House and the Senate side, the Alaska Municipal League, as of just a week ago, barely more than a week ago, have described their position as qualified non-opposition rather than opposed, which is the position they used to take. What Senate Bill 162 would do a couple of important things and reaffirm a couple of important things. Maybe the first is that there is no other tax, or there is no other asset that Alaska treats the way they treat gold and silver. As far as I know, in any locality in Alaska, if you were to pull out your phone and download one of the many financial brokerage apps and you use that app to buy stocks, bonds, ETFs, Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, any of those things, you would not pay a sales tax. There is not typically a sales tax anywhere in the country on assets like this. Additionally, studies have shown that this is a very inefficient form of taxation. Like I mentioned earlier, bullion investors are uniquely mobile, and there are a lot of opportunities to be able to acquire these metals without having to pay the tax. I also say that taxing harms local businesses. Like I mentioned, it's very simple to go to another store, or another storefront, or even online to endorse and to invest in these assets. Another point is that the people who typically invest in these assets are not typically fat cat, wealthy investors. These are typically people making small purchases at a time, with every paycheck going to buy U.S. minted silver eagles or various items like that that are pure, that are IRA eligible in many cases. And so it's not, large wealthy people, because the wealthy investors typically have access to greater forms of investment. They're buying ETFs, they're buying shares of gold that are stored institutionally. They're not typically buying physical precious metals. That's something that's done more modest investors do things like this. And like was mentioned in the Senator Cronk's introduction, this is a constitutional bill. Article 1, Section 10 says that no state shall make anything but gold and silver a tender in the payment of debts. That does not mean that the state needs to involve itself or create an alternative financial system or anything like that. This bill is very simple in that all it does is address the tax so that if people choose to invest or use gold and silver as money, they can do so with parity to other investment vehicles that are already legally accessible. This would reaffirm its status as constitutional money, which is largely symbolic. Like was mentioned, there is no mandate for the state to accept it or for vendors to accept it. The legal tender part is just the state agreeing and reaffirming that the Constitution says this and putting Alaska further in alignment with that U.S. constitutional mandate. So for that reason and others, I strongly encourage the committee to vote yes on Senate Bill 162. I'm very, very thankful for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm available for any questions if the committee has any. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cortez. Are there any questions for J.P. Cortez? Okay, hearing and seeing none, I will go ahead and bring this back to the committee. I just wanted to note that we do have Sandra Moeller, who's the director of the Division of Community and Regional Affairs of the Department of Commerce. She's online for questions only. Are there any questions for Ms. Moeller? All right, hearing and seeing none, we'll bring it back to the table. Senator Cronk or Mr. Menke, do you have any comments you'd like to make about the bill?
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. We just appreciate the time, appreciate the committee's willingness to listen to the bill, and look forward to working together to make the bill even better.
How much is this worth?
We're watching you. I don't know.
Anybody know how much this is worth?
For the record, Paul Mankey, I'm not sure how much it's worth, but it is worth its weight in gold, so I'm not sure.
All right. Senator Wilikowski.
The issues are coming back to me a little bit from last time around. But Section 7, defines legal tender, and it says to the fullest extent legal tender in the state includes species issued by, and then it goes line 23, a foreign government. And I know last time around we got into some questions about, well, what if there's a question about a foreign government? And I'm not going to get into countries that some say exist and some don't say exist, but that gives me a little concern, allowing issued by a foreign government. Does that cause any concern for you, or is there any issues with requiring the acceptance of specie from a foreign government?
For the record, Paul Menke, staff to Senator Mike Cronk, through the chair to Senator Willikowski. So this bill would not require that any entity accept the currency by a foreign government. Typically, if you're like referring to, there's a currency, and I'm blanking on the name of it, in, I believe, South Africa, that has its weight and its purity stamped on it. So that could be considered a specie, but again, no private or public entity would be required to accept it.
Good. Senator Willikowski? Okay. Thank you very much. We look forward to working with you and bringing this bill forward again with some modifications. We'll go ahead and set Senate Bill 162 aside for a future hearing. Thank you. And we'll take a brief at ease. Okay, I'd like to call the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting back to order, where we now have a presentation on on domestic violence and sexual assault. We have Brenda Stanfield, the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and a presentation. And if you could state your name and your affiliation for the record, thank you for coming.
Thank you. I'm Brenda Stanfield. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and I am joined today.
I am Rebecca Shields. I'm the Executive Director of the Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center.
And when we get partway through the presentation, we'll swap, and then we'll have Christine Pate, who's the Legal Services Director at the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, join us at the table. So, again, thank you for allowing us this opportunity today to talk about domestic violence and sexual assault, two issues that we all know there's been a lot of conversation. We've been in a lot of conversations this week. As the entire network, which is the audience behind us, as you see, come in from all over Alaska. They run direct service programs throughout the state. That this is one of the issues that really impacts Alaska in a very negative way. So we want to talk today about two systems that address them. We have the criminal justice system, and we also have the civil justice system. So not all of the systems, but just two of those. So I wanted to give you an idea of where the programs are across the state. As you see, we are from Unalaska all the way up to Utqiagvik and down into Ketchikan, all the way over to Hooper Bay. So we are throughout the state. There's 24 member programs that are providing services to those impacted by domestic violence and sexual assault. These are also programs that are funded by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and so you'll hear us talking about budgetary things when it comes to the council also. So, we appreciate that. Oftentimes, we think about these programs in a way that we don't really think about that 19 of our programs are in rural Alaska, and 16 of those programs are not on the road system. So, oftentimes, trying to get individuals in and out or coming into Anchorage if they need to access some type of additional safety, oftentimes there's a lot of travel involved in trying to attain safety for a victim. And then collectively last year, they responded to over 10,000 incidences of violence within the state of Alaska. So why are we coming to you and talking about this again year after year? Well, our rates are bad. They're bad. We're 5.4 times the national average for our Alaska violent crimes rate. And just recently, sitting on the Criminal Justice Data Analysis Commission, I found out that our violent crime rate does not include fourth degree assault, our misdemeanor assault. So we may even be a little bit worse. Our aggravated assaults, which again, that is only if it's an assault with a weapon. It doesn't include our fourth degree assaults that most domestic violence charges are. We're 6.7 times the national average, and our reported rape rates were 3.1 times the national average. So we don't look good. We've got, and that's just what's reported. We know that there's some, but it's bad. But I just want to say there's also hope, because I think sometimes we come year after year and we're like, oh, it's bad. Well, it started out really bad, and now it's bad. So we're making progress. And the reason I say that is if you look at this top slide, in 2010, we started something called the Choose Respect Initiative. And the Choose Respect Initiative was started by an administration who said, we're going to target a lot of effort, energy, and resources to address domestic violence and sexual assault. But one of the things we need to know is, how bad are we? And so they commissioned the Alaska Victimization Survey. This is a survey that the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, which is the state entity, and we're the nonprofit entity, the state entity actually commissions this every 5 years. We are in the process of doing the 2025 at this time. But in 2010, when they did this, if you look there at the bottom, that composite number, we had 29,174 individual Alaskan women. This was only, women were the only ones in this survey that were impacted by domestic violence or sexual assault within the past 12 months. If you look at 2015, after a five-year, very intensive, concentrated effort through the Choose Respect campaign, you see that we went down to 21,401, which is about a 28% decrease in those that were victimized over the last 12 months. That's a pretty significant decrease. Between 2015 and 2020, one of the things that happened is we didn't really invest anymore in what we were doing. We stopped the outreach efforts that were happening. The PSAs quit running. The community events bringing people together got fewer and fewer. And what we saw between 2015 and 2020 is we just treaded water. We didn't lose ground, but we also didn't gain ground in bringing it down. And so I do believe that we have found something, that if we can get back to doing that investment, and that investment was much more than just marches. It was investment in pilot projects on what type of probation. I was listening to that Veterans Court, and I was thinking, ooh, you know, maybe there's some ways to connect the dots in here in what we could do to ensure that someone who is abusing their family, who's seen trauma, could access the necessary resources they need. Right now, we don't have a lot of resources for those who are doing harm. So there's a lot we can do, and we look forward to continuing to work with you. In the communities we want to talk about today, we want to have Kodiak, a women's resource center. Rebecca Shields is going to talk to you about how she's working with her community to pull together and work as a team to try to address the victims, the victimization through the criminal justice system. And then Christine Pate will be talking to you about what we're doing as a statewide effort to pull the programs together to be able to work in the civil justice system to make a difference. So with that, I'll turn it to Rebecca.
Thank you so much. Once again, my name is Rebecca Shields. I'm the executive director of the Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center. And I am very proud of the work that we do. As Brenda was pointing out, it still is bad across the state of Alaska. And one of the things that we're really trying hard to do is work collaboratively with our community partners and in a victim-centered sort of a way. So in Kodiak, Alaska, we combine our CCR and SART. CCR is our Community Coordinated Response Team, and our SART is our Sexual Assault Response Team. The teams are founded on the SART multidisciplinary form of response, and our teams consist of law enforcement, advocates, forensic medical providers, which are our immediate response team, the people that are called out to the crimes of domestic violence and sexual assault. And then we have our broader scope, which is our community collaborative and community building, which also includes team members such as Office of Children's Services, probation officers, the district attorney's office, the emergency room, nurses, and so forth. Anyone that is interactive with clients or with victims in the criminal justice response. So when a crime happens, either domestic violence or sexual assault, we go into an immediate response as a community. So if a crime has been reported to law enforcement and is entering into the criminal justice system, law enforcement will notify our sexual assault CCR coordinator at the Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center. The advocate then makes contact with the victim ASAP. It's very important for us to be able to introduce ourselves to the victim, allow the victim to get to know who we are, what our role is, and that we are kind of their tour guides, if you will, through the rest of the system. If needed, if there is a injury or if a SART exam is needed, then the advocate will set up with our forensic medical provider a time for an exam and to take forensic pictures. The advocate, of course, remains with the victim throughout that process. And then the advocate stays with the victim throughout the interview with law enforcement, as well as the forensic exam. So the role of the advocate, once again, is to stay with the victim, answer questions. This is such a time of trauma for the victim that oftentimes we just explain to them what is happening in a way that they understand and give them their power back so that they can make decisions for themselves of what it is that they want to do. So it's very important to recognize that the CCR is a victim-centered service. So in Kodiak, the Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center, we are the coordinators of our CCR team. In order for it to remain victim-centered, we build relationships, building trust within the different systems in the criminal justice system, all of the people that are going to be responding. We do a lot of training. We do a lot of talking about our differing roles as team members, what each team member is, what their role is and what their response is during this time. We do cross-training of systems, and we maintain team infrastructure to keep our team healthy. And then the most important is to maintain that the team is victim-centered. I want to remind that in cases of domestic violence that when a victim enters into the criminal justice system, oftentimes her lethality really increases, that throughout her experience she has been threatened that if you speak of this, if you go to the police, I will seek you out and harm you. So the victim is often scared in cases of domestic violence. And in sexual assault cases, again, I would remind you that these are the most personal and intimate forms of crime. And speaking of it and going through this process is so traumatizing for the victim. So with the CCR, we surround the victim with, of course, advocacy that is there to keep the victim informed of what's happening and what she can expect and what her choices are within it. And then our leadership informing our roles around that and staying in constant communication, evaluating and monitoring the consequences of what's happening and identifying gaps and problems and finding solutions. This is what the system looks like to a victim. So when a crime happens, there's so many other things that happen all at the same time in the life of a victim that it can be so completely overwhelming. So once again, the role of the advocate is very unique in that we stay with the victim and help them monitor and navigate all of the very many different systems that they are now going to have to go through in order to achieve and maintain safety. And that is our first and foremost priority, is to keep our eye on safety planning and the safety of the victim during this time. So as far as the second part of our CCR SART team, which is just the broader relationship building. Our monthly meetings are run in two parts. The first part is our case management portion, and this just consists of the most immediate responders to the case if the case is in the criminal justice system, in which we will do what we call a case review. The advocate basically remains quiet during this session, but is there so that we can attain kind of where we are or where the victim is in the system so that we can later help keep her abreast of that. But we don't offer any real information due to our confidentiality. But all of the members that are in this portion of the meeting are all there through release of information and have been spoken about and approved by the victim. And then after our case management part of the meeting, we have the broader part of the team's meeting in which we invite all of the rest of our team members, and we work on training and building relationships and maintaining all of the areas that need to be upheld and kept in court in order for us to continue to have a healthy and victim-centered group so that we can meet the needs of our victims. And that is our community response in Kodiak. I thank you for allowing me to talk today, and if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Yes, thank you very much for the presentation. I guess I do just have generalized questions, especially for, like, you live on an island, so there might be maybe some hesitancy. We have it even in Fairbanks, which is a big city comparatively, but are there times where a person doesn't want to report or doesn't want to come to a center simply because they're going to know everybody there? And how do you address those types of issues?
Thank you, Chair. Yes. Okay. Reporting, I think, is one of the most difficult things that victims do. As a victims response center, we are able to offer our services to victims regardless of whether they're going through the criminal justice system or not. And that's one of the things that we will address, you know, with victims when we meet them, what our role is, and that regardless of what's happening in the criminal justice system, we will be here for them. So that's part of the services that we offer. One of the things that makes it possible and safe for advocates to play the role that we do is confidentiality, which is the second part of what we try to explain as we meet people, that during this time, the focus of the advocate is we are the ones that are there only for the victim. We are not there because of the criminal justice system. And that anything that the victim says to us or any interactions that she has with us are held in confidentiality to maintain her safety and her comfort.
Great. Thank you very much for the testimony about the Kodiak Island facilities. We'll go ahead and move next to the next presentation. We've got Christine Pate with the Network Legal Program Director.
Yes, thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to talk about an issue that is very near and dear to my heart, which is civil legal services for survivors of domestic and sexual violence. I started at the network many, many years ago. I was a legal services attorney actually up in Fairbanks, I was serving victims of domestic and sexual violence, and I was brought over to the network to start our direct services program. At that time, what we heard from our member programs was civil legal services was a huge need in our programs. They were not able to find attorneys to go into court for them. So what are civil legal services, and how are they important for survivors? Let me paint you a picture. Imagine you're a young mother of two children and your husband is physically abusing you. You don't work as you are the stay-at-home parent. Every few weeks there's acts of strangulation, hair pulling, kicking, screaming obscenities at you in front of your small children. As time goes on, you consider leaving, but your husband tells you that if you do, he'll kill you and he'll take your children. You're afraid to call the police because your husband might lose his job, and you've heard that child protection services could take your children. What do you need to get safe? You need a protection order because leaving, as you just heard, is the most dangerous time for victims. You need custody of your children to keep your children safe. And you need spousal support to pay your bills and child support to financially help you to get on your feet. These are all services that only a civil legal attorney, not the criminal justice system, unfortunately, can provide to you. So, this first slide is really, you've heard a little bit about this, but I know everybody is always like, why do people stay in these relationships? And we know that they stay because sometimes it's more dangerous for them to leave. They don't have housing, especially in our state where housing is so difficult. They don't have access to financial resources. They have been told repeatedly that if they leave, their partner will take the children, and we know that family court is a very dangerous place for victims. They do not have access to resources. Resources have been used as a control against a survivor. And so our program started actually as a volunteer attorney program with very limited resources. And this next slide was what I would use to convince, cajole, and sometimes coerce volunteers to take cases. A study funded by the Department of Justice found that providing legal services to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault is one of the most effective means of ending violence. So I know we all struggle with how can we end this problem in the civil legal arena. We have the tools to end the problem. We have the tools to get people safe and effective custody and visitation orders. We have the tools to get people safe and effective protective orders. It's having an attorney in court with them. We have the tools to get them child support and spousal support so that they can start a new career and restart their lives. Those are things that only the civil legal services can provide.
If you take a pause right there, Senator Bjorkman has a question for you.
Sure.
Thank you very much for the presentation. My question is, you made a statement that family court is not a safe place for victims. Can you help me understand why?
Domestic relations court is one of the most dangerous places in the court system. You'll hear that, I'm sure, from Ms. Mead also, because there is so much at stake, and domestic violence is such a dangerous thing. When an abusive partner is losing potential access to their children, potential access to their partner, there is a lot of lethality in those cases. And so it is a very dangerous time for victims, and it can be a dangerous time for courts and judges and attorneys going into those cases.
I understand. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah, thank you for that question. So this slide, I think, just kind of reinforces what I was just talking about in terms of the remedies that are needed and why attorneys are important. But what we know also is that 80% of people that go through the court system in domestic relations cases, which are the primary types of cases we're doing, are unrepresented. The criminal justice system, as you've heard, is an invaluable partner to us. It is a very key component to ending domestic violence in our state. But the civil justice system, this is a comparison in various areas of them, is incredibly important also. Why? I think there's a study that shows that 50% of victims of violence never even access the criminal justice system. They don't because they may not trust the police. They may be afraid to access it because of child protection services. They may have other reasons why they don't want to do that. But because of that, the civil justice system is what catches them. Often when police go to the scene of a crime, if they don't think they have probable cause to make an arrest, they send people to protective order court to get a remedy. Why is this slide important? There's a few things I want to point out. As my associate here was telling you, confidentiality is really important in the criminal justice system. Once you start talking to the police or a prosecutor, there's no confidentiality, and you lose control of your case. In the civil justice system, if you have an attorney, you are in control. You can say if you want that case to go on or not. You can decide what the remedies are in that case. So it's, in certain ways, a more empowering system. It also has, as I've said, expanded remedies besides incarceration and maybe some monetary compensation. Most importantly, though, in the difference is there's no right to counsel in the civil system. In the criminal system, if you go out and you over-imbibe one night and you get a DUI, you have the right to an attorney in your case if you're indigent. In the civil system, if you are facing the loss of your children in a custody case against your abuser, there's no right to counsel. If you're a sexual assault victim and the state has not prosecuted your case and your only remedy is to get a protective order, there's no right to counsel. These are all cases where people have to go into the system unrepresented. So, what has been our solution? It's to put together a program that serves survivors. Our program at ANSVA comes through our member programs. We consider our programs a partner with us in the case. They refer the cases to us. We partner also with our other patchwork of civil legal providers in this state. And when I say patchwork, it's a really small world of people doing this work. Alaska Legal Services, who you've probably heard of and know, does a small number of these, or a good number of these cases around the state. The Alaska Native Justice Center in Anchorage has one or two attorneys dedicated to this. Our member programs have a small number of attorneys, and then it's us at ANSVA, three attorneys and two paralegals, doing this work statewide. What are the types of cases we're doing? Large array of civil cases, which can include landlord-tenant, consumer cases, wills and probate, victims' issues and rights issues in court, but mostly it's family law cases. It's the domestic relations cases that I've been talking about and protective order work. That is by far the largest part of the pie of what we're doing. How do we staff our cases? We do it through our small staff, but we have really been able to leverage resources through the Alaska Bar. We use contract attorneys for many of our cases. That allows us to geographically access more people around the state. We pay attorneys at a very reduced rate from their regular rate. And then we are very blessed to have a large quantity of volunteer attorneys. Again, that's how I started our program, relying on volunteers. Some of them are in this building. Senator Klayman was one of our volunteers. Cliff Groh, former Representative Cliff Groh, we've just talked into a protective order in Anchorage. And so we've been very blessed with that. This is just an overview of some of our statistics. Last year, we served 363 survivors around the state. As I said, our survivors come from our member programs. AWAKE is our Anchorage program. It's by far the largest area that we're serving, but it is all over the state that we are serving folks. And then this is our volunteers. Again, the bar, I think, sees the great need for access to justice in the civil legal arena, and they step up. And we have had $417,000 of donated services. When you combine that with our contract attorneys, it turns into almost $700,000 of donated services around the state. So we're a very financially efficient program, shall I say, that has worked. These are some of our volunteers. We try to raise them up and really appreciate everything that they do for us. And then these are just some testimonials from some of our clients and what they've had to say in terms of how important a civil legal attorney is. So, you know, our courts rely on a system of justice that talks about equal access to justice. If you're in a case where one side has an attorney and the other side does not, there is no equal access to justice. In the world of domestic violence and sexual assault, that is tenfold because of the imbalance of power. Victims freeze in court. They cannot get their evidence in front of a court. And if we wonder why judges don't make the right decisions sometimes, it's because they weren't able to get the evidence because there wasn't an attorney there to help a survivor. So it's a really critical part, I think, of the picture of ending violence in our state, and thank you so much. Happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you very much. And I just wanted to note that in the volunteer appreciation, Bobby Allen is one of the volunteers who was a very young intern here maybe a decade ago or so. But she's gone on to law school, and then now she's a full attorney in Alaska.
She has. She's doing a great job.
Good. That's great to hear. I did have a question, and I don't know if anybody can answer this, but it has to do with just the funding streams and where funding just comes in, comes out. We've heard of some issues with child advocacy centers, with just generally, and maybe you're the best person to answer this, but during that 2010-2014 timeframe, we did have the big push to sort of deal a lot with the domestic violence, sexual assault, and a real focus on it. And I don't know, like, is there just less focus on it? Is there just too many priorities? I guess, what are we to think about that?
Brenda Stanfill, Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, to the chair. You know, I think it does oftentimes take a bit of a top-down approach in order to make the statewide changes that we're trying to make. And we've seen this in a few different ways. When we needed to make some changes in how the Alaska State Troopers investigated, we kept trying to promote that with each division. We'd go to the captain. But once the commissioner said, hey, things are going to be different, and then that top-down came down, all of a sudden things were different. Training changed. Checklist changed. And we saw the same thing. When the governor stood up and said, this is something that we cannot tolerate in our state, and we're going to make changes. I remember being at the shelter. This was when I was still in the Fairbanks shelter there and had been there for many, many years. We were listening to his address in the kitchen area of our shelter, and a woman started to cry, and she said, "This is the first time I've actually felt like anyone cared about what I'm experiencing and that I feel hope." And so just having that, where you have people who stood up with the first Choose Respect March we did, the trooper, I'd been trying to do, you'll probably remember, maybe you and I were all alone at a few marches that we tried to put together. And, you know, there'd be a handful of people. The first Choose Respect March and an event that we did in Fairbanks, it was 50 below, it was cold. It was in March, doing a march. And Fairbanks, that's not so comfortable. But the troopers were there. There had been a mandate that you will show up. We had AG Dan Sullivan was the attorney general at the time, and he came to speak at that event and to put hope in that we truly were going to address these. We started a probationary program that actually got people into the treatment that they needed and had some incentives to it. So there was really there was an effort. And so I think that what has happened is that sometimes perspectives of what will work shift, and no one really went back and said, "Hey, that was actually working." But now we've got some time to see that actually it was working. It's the only time we've seen that shift, and it was what we did different during those 5 years. And so I think that this is just a matter of calling attention to it again, that, hey, we were doing things that worked. Let's get back there. And I don't understand your question on the funding streams, but I'm happy to answer that.
Well, just, we've heard of the Victims of Crimes VOCA money and just the federal line item, but are there other sources of funds that are no longer available, particularly through the network?
The large drop happened with the change in VOCA. So at our high time, we had about $9 million that came through. At our low time, we went down to about 1.5, and it slowly made its way back up to 3. But there's about a $6 million gap in there. If you remember, about 4 years ago, we were in this building saying, "Help us out, we're taking a cut." So we worked really hard that year to not take a cut. We got $3 million of it from you all at that time. And then Senator Murkowski arranged for an appropriation for three different times to give us $3 million, also making up that $6 million. This year, a very hard decision was made by the council to say that we can't cut the victim service programs, and we don't know what's going to happen because we're still missing that $3 million. And so they are no longer funding the what we call the enhanced services, which is the legal services you just heard about, and also the child advocacy centers. So we have been working to get those funds in a different way while at the same time making sure that our victim services programs also have a request to get them up to where they've got the spending power basically of 2017. They've been flat funded since 2017. The grants have just been exactly the same, and their utilities have gone up a tad bit. Cost of living during that time is a 24% increase. And so we're asking that these be looked at to make sure that we can gain ground from what we're losing.
Thank you, Ms. Stanfill. Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. You had mentioned, and maybe I missed it, but I think it's good to repeat things sometimes. We were doing things different for 5 years. What exactly were we doing differently?
The Choose Respect, we always call it the Choose Respect campaign, and so you just think of the posters and the march, because that was the real public facing. There was a lot of PSAs that were running during that time, and of course, the more information you get out there about the services that are available or how this is not appropriate. But the other thing is we were doing more prevention efforts. So like if you go out to Tanana, they've still got a lot of posters out there, but they were getting the schools involved, and the kids were talking about what is respect. They were talking about health relationships. We were doing a lot of work to just bring up awareness. It was about a $30 million overall investment in that. But one of the primary things that was also happening behind the scenes was looking at the offender side of it. Because, you know, you kind of need three parts. You need the community to change, you need the victim to stay safe, and you need the offender to be accountable in some way. And there was really a concentrated effort to start looking at those with repeat offenses. We were doing something called the ODARA. It's a scoring that you do, and anybody who is scoring a certain score of, like, you're a pretty dangerous person, there was a requirement that they do certain things associated with probation. They were getting them into treatment, or I'll say educational groups and those kind of things, holding them accountable for it, looking at some carrot part of it, like instead of the felony, we can get you the misdemeanor if you'll go through these treatment programs. Because this is a learned behavior. This is something that you learn through life. You're not just this way. You've experienced trauma. You've experienced things in your life. Things have happened to you. And you grow up to be an adult that harms your family, because oftentimes you just don't have anywhere else to put it. And so we do know that this behavior can be unlearned, but oftentimes it takes a bit of usually the court system to get you into those programs that could help you be different in your life. So it was definitely an effort that included these things, and it also had the backing of the Alaska Mental Health Trust, who was looking at treatment options, making sure people could get into substance abuse treatment, get into mental health. So it was really a concentrated effort across the state to pull all these systems together. Like you heard us talk about the CCR, it really takes all the systems, because it's connected in so many ways to every system we have.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Follow up. Go ahead.
Well, thank you all for being here today. My next question is, what would you like us to do? How can we help?
Well, that $30 million commitment, really, I think what I would love to do this morning in a hearing, one of the representatives says, you know, in June, we need to come together and we really need to start talking about this. Right. I think we do. I think that we have these opportunities during session and we come before you and we talk and different things. But, you know, we have the Criminal Justice Data Analysis Commission that will be meeting tomorrow. Mm-hmm. They've done a really deep dive on domestic violence in the court system, kind of seen some trends, some things happening. You know, just bringing people together who have the ability to make a difference, and it's you all. I mean, you all have the ability to make a difference. We saw when it came from the Alaska government, from those who make decisions about us, that we can make a difference. And I would love to see us come together and form a group that says, we're going to sit down and figure out how could we make the investment, and let's look at what other states have done. Let's try to model some things. Let's try some pilot programs to see if we can bring these rates down. You know, look at things like wellness court, veterans court, those kind of things. We can't just have a punitive system and think that we're going to criminalize our way out of this very intensive social issue with the historical generational trauma we have. We have so many things that this is going to take a very concentrated effort with some very dedicated people. And that's what I would ask, is that we look at that and then we figure out a funding strategy to make sure that we can bring this back into our state.
Thank you, Ms. Sadler. I'm glad that you brought up the $30 million. I think that should not be understated. It was when, at a time right after Governor Palin introduced legislation changing the tax system, we were flush with cash, and that was a priority of the administration at the time, was to invest in a campaign. And I'll say that I think it did show results. Out of that $30 million that was embedded over those couple years, how much of that money still exists somewhere within the existing base? Or is it all, I understand, like, it was fluctuating year to year, but how much of that $30 million do you think still remains within the base?
I would have to phone a friend or two or three, I think, to figure that out. I know during that time there was additional dollars that went to probation and to a Department of Law and different things. I don't think we ever saw something that said it went away. But I do think that as other things took priority, possibly it got absorbed. And then also, if you remember, we that next administration, we went through a lot of decreases. So Department of Public Safety took a big hit. Department of Law took a hit. So it very well could have been that that's how it shifted back. But I'm just speaking without having looked extensively at those budgets to compare the two. So probably those departments could tell you really what happened from this time period to this time period. What I can say for victim services is that we didn't actually receive a big increase at that time. We received some modest ones, and we have not lost general funds. We've gained some general funds. It's just that we've been filling it in with federal funds for so long. We didn't have to increase general funds, if that made sense. So we have not kept anything additional from that time period.
Thank you. And the committee will do a little bit of research on that, I think, to try and figure out where the campaign was effective and really like the dollars and cents and where they directed. Senator Bjorkman, do you have a question?
Just a closing comment, I think. Thanks again, everyone, for being here. I think a lot of our social problems that we wish for people to have more resources personally and corporately in order to deal with, we have a choice on how to handle them, right? Whether it is a more conservative approach of unleashing the armies of compassion through religious organizations and nonprofits, or enabling government organizations to do what they do as well, the choice is there for society to make. And if we choose not to decide anything, like Rush tells us, that's still a choice. And so I think that's a big explanation of why we are where we are with this issue and kind of the other issues that are walking around the building today. Many of us heard from people with blue and white scarves about how kids can't get access to primary care because there's not enough money for that. And we have heard many times about kids in the foster care system about how they can't get what they need because there's not enough money for guardians and there's not enough money for OCS caseworkers to be effective. And so all of these things walk around the building and visit us kind of in this way of different specters that come to us with these asks for tens of millions of dollars and what do we do? And so I think as a society, we need to do a better job of answering that question corporately about what exactly are the costs of our choices and what do we choose to prioritize or not. And I think it's important for all of us to educate the people in our neighborhoods and communities about the choices that we make together when we talk about what our priorities are. And I hope that people can begin to understand the gravity of that a little bit more. Because when we choose not to invest in ourselves as a society, whether it be infrastructure or education or making sure that vulnerable people are protected, those choices degrade and erode the very foundations of our society that make it easier for things to get worse and worse. And so we do need to do this work, and it needs to be an all hands on deck situation. As we are in the financial situation we're in, certainly look for ways that we can do things without money. However, with the understanding that nothing is free and there's no free ride to solve these problems. And so if we want to fix and do the real work, we have to be willing to pay for it. And I think that's the message that more people need to hear about anything in life. And so thank you for bringing this message. I appreciate you all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much for the presentation today. And for folks who ended up staying late, we do appreciate that very much. That concludes the meeting for today. The next meeting is March 3rd, where we will hear Senate Bill 237 relating to data sharing and Social Security Administration. It is sponsored by the Senate State Affairs Committee, and we would hope to move it out at that time. We also hear bills previously heard or scheduled. Without any other business coming before the committee, this meeting is adjourned. Let the record reflect that it's 5:15.